Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com.
Hey y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson, and from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. The song you're hearing is called Armageddon's Back in Town. It's from the Drive-By Truckers' new album, The Unraveling, which comes out January 31st. Patterson Hood, our guest today, co-founded the band in 1996 with his longtime musical partner, Mike Cooley. Hood's father, David Hood, played bass in the Swampers, a legendary studio group from Muscle Shoals, Alabama, that played on hits by everybody from Aretha Franklin to Paul Simon. Patterson Hood and the rest of the Drive-By Truckers have spent more than 20 years exploring the psyche of the South in their music. And lately, they've turned their gaze outward to the full American experience. Here's my conversation with Patterson Hood. Obviously, I would think that you would know growing up that your dad and all these other folks were musicians.
Sure.
When did it sort of dawn on you that they had done the things that they had done, played with, Aretha and
You know, Dad everybody. Had me young. I mean, my parents were teenagers. Dad had just turned 20 when I was born. So, and he played his first sessions when I was two. So I grew up around him doing it, and I knew that he played music for a living, but it really sank in when I was about seven and when I'll Take You There became a hit, because Dad's the bass player on that. All songs built around the bass part, that boom, 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 boom. You know, it's very iconic. And there's a shout out to him in the breakdown of the song. Mavis Staples says, "David, little David, you know, play it funky now," or something like that. And so I can remember being seven, hearing it on the radio in the car and thinking, that's my dad, you know, that's pretty cool.
I want to stop. Did you know at the time that was like, people around the country were listening to that?
Because I was into music. I was pretty into it all. So I was, you know, especially starting around that time. I started writing songs when I was eight. So you know, that's right around the time that I started really kind of awakening to, you know, that there was music beyond the Beatles.
Right.
You know, because, you know, all kids love the Beatles. And I'm old enough that I was a kid when there still were Beatles making, you know, new records. And I was really loved them. I knew. And so from then on, I pretty much kept up with, Dad never talked about it. He never brought work home with him as far as he wouldn't talk about it. In fact, to a point of, you know, it was probably an annoyance to me growing up because I wanted him to. I would ask questions and he would just give me a two-word answer and change the subject. He didn't want to talk about it.
And do you feel like that family background, or maybe the prominence that your dad and his buddies had in the music industry, has that ever, you felt like, helped or hurt either way?
It was weird because Dad didn't encourage it. I mean, he was not –
Was he one of those guys like, don't do what I did?
Yeah, very much. He wanted me to be a pharmacist or something. And I actually got a job as a, I guess maybe at around 20 at a pharmacy, and he was really excited because I liked the job. I liked working there. He's like, he's gonna do something. He's gonna make something of himself other than this crazy thing he's trying to do. And Dad and I went at music from opposite ends of it because, you know, Dad was a session guy, and those guys are like for starters, they're really badass players. I mean, they're like, you know, they're super, everything is super precise and perfect. I mean, their job is to make it perfect and preferably really quickly. And, you know, and I grew up, you know, punk rock happened when I was in junior high school, and I totally embraced just the recklessness of that. You know, it's probably partly too as a, I wouldn't say rebellion to it, but maybe as a reaction to the perfection of the studio records. You know, I can remember the handful of times I'd go to the studio, I'd hear them working on stuff, and I thought it was cooler before it got so perfect. When it was a little bit rougher, you know, when they were still working it out, I tended to like that better than the finished result. And my dad thought that was a screw. He couldn't fathom that. And of course, the whole punk rock thing, he totally didn't get that at the time. Ironically, he does now. He likes a lot of those records now. But at the time, he thought they were just terrible.
I think you posted something on social media the other day about Mike Cooley, that you guys have been together playing for 34 years now.
Yeah.
Longer than the vast majority of marriages.
Yeah.
And I guess I wonder what. Do you have any, I hope this is not a silly question, sort of relationship tips on how to make that sort of creative relationship work long term?
I think if you have nicknames for each other that are just foul and terrible and you embrace that day one.
I want to hear them now.
I think I can't say them on the radio, but, you know, every morning we address each other in the worst possible way. Healthy. I think that might be the secret, you know, in retrospect. It kind of occurred to me this morning, you know, when I woke up and he goes, you know, morning, mother, you know, and, you know, I think that might be the secret, you know. I mean, it, obviously, you know, it takes more than that, but I think that helps. I think because then there's you know up front that anything goes. You can just say whatever, you know, you know, he and I mean, it's an amazing relationship. It really is. It didn't come easy because we're very, very, very different. And when we were young and we were hot-headed, you know, I think he was 19 when we started playing together and I was 21. And so it was, you know, we basically fought constantly for the first 10 years. But obviously we kept going, so there was something. There was good enough chemistry that we somehow had enough sense, as dumb as we were, to continue forward, even though we didn't really get along that good. We were like, it was like brothers. It was like brothers fighting, you know. We never really came to blows. But he took a swing at me one night on stage, but he was pretty drunk, and he missed. He swung at the wrong – it was like three of me, and I think he picked the wrong one to swing at. So I just kind of stepped back, and it was like something out of a movie. But yeah, we never really got physical violent, but we've fought a lot, you know, those first 10 years. And then the second 10 years, we really kind of figured out how to do it. And then the last 10 years, we've gotten like really close, you know, we're good friends. I mean, he came and vacationed I live in Portland now, and his family had their family vacation this summer out in Portland. And like we, you know, the idea a few years ago of us vacationing together was pretty, you know, pretty funny, but we had a great time. I think his family had a great time, and it was lovely, you know.
And do you have that kind of old married couple thing? Like, do you, yeah. I mean, do you finish each other's thoughts verbally and or musically? I mean,
to some extent, I mean, we're still opposites, but that's part of the beauty of it. You know, we're opposites working on the same thing. So it obviously we're, you know, there's more common ground than difference. But and as we've gotten older, we're more aware of that and the importance of what the difference brings to the table. You know, I think the secret to the greatest bands are made up of people that you cannot imagine actually working or playing together, that somehow it works. You know, REM being like a classic example. If you, you know, get to know those four people as individuals. There's no way in hell that that could work. And yet they were a band for 30 plus years, you know, and they're still friends, you know. So and so I think there's a lot of that in our band. I think that's a big part of our band's chemistry, is the different things that somehow coexist and work well together. Makes it interesting.
Yeah. So I want to talk about, or want to ask about, when you guys sit down to make a new record, kind of how that works. Because I want to talk about this in a little later. I feel like, you know, the kind of things you're writing about, singing about, have evolved, obviously, over the years. Does it come like you write songs and then that sort of determines what the record's going to be? Or do you guys talk in sort of conceptual terms and then go the other way?
The songs come first, with one exception, and that was Southern Rock Opera. We definitely had the idea for that before the majority of those songs, and it was such a ridiculous, harebrained, kind of on paper horrifically bad idea that we were all attracted to that. You know, that says something about Cooley and I. That's probably one of the areas where he and I obviously have some kind of common ground. We both will follow a bad idea really, really far and figure out a way to make it actually into something good. And that might be the other secret besides calling each other horrific things. So on that one, you know, we really it started out as an idea for a screenplay I was going to try to write. Myself and a guy named Earl Hicks, who used to be in the band, although this was before he was in the band. It even predated the band a little bit. And Earl and I had this idea one day over just a long road trip we were on when he was in the process of moving to Georgia. And we were in like a U-Haul truck without a radio, and we started talking, and it kind of became this brainstorming thing about this idea to write a screenplay about this fictional band, but kind of use the Lynyrd Skynyrd mythology and story as the basis for it. And then over the next 6 years, it evolved into a record and an examination of growing up in the post-civil rights South and coming to terms with, you know, all that us Southern boys who, you know, try to be woke and aware, for use of a, you know, more modern term, I guess, of all that. The things you have to come to terms with, you know, And so it really morphed and evolved into something that, you know, I mean, I'm real proud of. But when we started writing, we would write for that project. And in the meantime, we were doing other things. We were making, writing, recording, and touring behind three other records while we were working on Southern Rock Opera. You know, as originally, I think we even thought it'd be a side project and we might not even call it Drive-By Truckers. And then it was kind of hell, this band's got a small following. We'd be crazy not to make this part of it, you know, and et cetera, et cetera. And while working on that, we were also writing the record after it, the Decoration Day album.
Yeah.
So that's just kind of the way we used to operate.
Tell me if you see this differently on the inside than I see it on the outside, that, you know, at the beginning, like you said, those first few records felt really explicitly Southern to me, and right, that you were trying to dig into this, exactly what you said, this whole, you know, what it means to be a Southern person now, looking back, kind of exploring the past a little bit and trying to make sense of it in the present. These last couple of records felt like you guys have been more obviously explicitly looking outward a little bit.
Right.
Kind of in more of an American sense. And is that, is there something besides Trump that has caused that for y'all? Or is that kind of boiling up?
Before. Yeah, I mean, definitely. Besides him, you know, I mean, because he wasn't even that big a factor yet when we were writing the last record, which, you know, it's hard to believe it's been that long since we put out the last record. That record's over 3 years old now. We cut it almost 4 years ago now. And, you know, and so we finished recording American Band before the first primary. And at that time, nobody really was taking him seriously. He was just this joke that everyone in New York hated, who was all of a sudden said he was running for president, and it was like a PR stunt. And so he wasn't really that big a part of that. But, you know, when we first started this band, when we were, you know, we weren't kids. I was in my 30s, but I guess Cooley was probably, he turned 30 around the time we started the Drive-By Truckers. And, you know, we had already played in Cooley, and this was our, Truckers was Cooley and I's fourth band. And, you know, if you listen to the Adams Housecat record, which finally came out about a year ago, the record we made in 1990, it was our, that was our, like our real serious band we had before the Truckers. And if you listen to that record, I mean, that record was like obsessed with getting out of town. We were like, we felt cooped up and trapped in our hometown that at that time was super economically depressed and super religiously conservative and politically conservative. And we were these punk kids that didn't feel like we belonged, and we were trying to get out of town. I mean, that was like a running theme in probably, you know, half the songs on that record. And so, you know, by the time we started the Truckers, I was living in Athens, Georgia, in a place that I thought was kind of, you know, heaven on earth. And Athens is such a wonderful town. And I was, you know, I had enough distance from home to start writing about it with a little more of a well-rounded look, you know, and I was, you know, kind of coming to terms. I was grown up enough to start really thinking about things like coming to terms with, you know, the southern part of our heritage and some of the dark parts of that, as, you know, and also maybe learning to appreciate some of the better parts of that. And so that was like a, you know, a big part of that. But you know, none of us had traveled a lot. I mean, you know, the first time we went to Europe as a band, which was after Southern Rock Opera came out, I believe I was the only one in the band that had ever been on an airplane. And I'd done a little traveling as a kid with my grandparents. I'd gone to South America and Canada with my grandparents and stuff. But I'd never, you know, I hadn't done a huge lot of traveling around America other than, you know, as we were writing Southern Rock Opera, the band was starting to play more and more all over the country. But, you know, now, I mean, I live on the road. I'm on the road, you know, I'm on the road an average of 100 days, you know, probably, you know, it ranges from 75 to 125 dates a year that we've been on the road for 20 plus years. And we play Europe and Australia and, you know, all over. And so, you know, it's easier to write about a wider swath. You write what you know. And so right. It's easier to write about places now that you've been to them, and you see that, oh, people really aren't that different other places, you know. And in the liner notes for American Band, the big part of the liner notes is about, you know, how people are always talking about, you know, North, South, and you know, the how different the South is, but it's not really the real divide in America at this point in time is more rural urban. And you know, and by the time we were making American Band, I had moved to Oregon with my family, and I was living in Portland, which is considered one of the most liberal cities in America, in the world. And I had noticed that if you drive 10 minutes in any direction outside of town, it could be Alabama. You know, I mean, it really could. You know, it's you know, it's trailer parks and Trump signs, and, you know, I guess there weren't Trump signs quite yet then, but there were soon after. I mean, it's, you know, rural Oregon is every bit as, you know, stereotypical of what you think of when people talk about the South as, you know. And I moved to Portland from Athens, Georgia. People are always like, oh, but you're having culture shock. It's like, no, Athens, Georgia is a lot like Portland. You know, it's a, you know, Athens, Georgia actually has a more liberal city government now than Portland does. And you know, there's not you know, other than the way it looks, it's not that different a town. You know, it's a lot. Portland's a lot bigger, and I'm enjoying living in a city. But you know, Athens is has always been a blue dot, and so that's you know, that's really a big, that was a big theme in our writing on the last record for sure.
Do you feel like, as somebody who kind of grew up in not rural necessarily, but kind of small town Alabama,
right?
Do you have a hunger to try to connect with those folks, to try to tell them, you know, what your story is, and try to move those folks in any way, or do you feel like it's too late? Or
I don't know if it's my job to do that. I don't know. My job is just to do my job the best I can, and if someone wants to listen to it and get something out of it, that's wonderful. Or if they get out of it is the guitars sound cool, I guess that's okay too. I don't know, you know. And you know, I try to, you know, I feel like a lot of people do connect with what we do, and I'm really feel blessed with that. And but I'm not really, I kind of don't allow myself to think about that too much when I'm in the process of trying to write it or make it. You know, when I'm trying to write, I'm just trying to, I've got something in my head, and I'm trying to be as true to what I heard in my head as I possibly can and get it written properly. And then my job is to learn how to play it, to do it justice, and hopefully it passes muster good enough to where then I throw it to the band. And once I throw it to the band, I let go. It becomes our song, and which is wonderful, you know, because I completely trust what they're going to do with it, and whether it's something I'd thought of before or not. And often it's not, you know, they may take it in some totally different place, and it's always better if they do. And so then the job's to make the record and make as good a record. And then the job is to learn how to do it live and turn it into hopefully a really good show, you know. And you know, our band's known for, we have a good show. We're a good live band. So that's kind of the different steps. And then everything else is out of our control.
When we come back, Patterson Hood talks about turning the turmoil in his life into music. Along those lines, here's one of the Drive-By Truckers' best songs, World of Hurt. More ahead on Southbound.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com.
If you'd like to be a part of the Southbound community, we'd love to hear from you. You can suggest ideas for future guests on our homepage at wfae.org/southbound. You can also email me at ttomlinson@wfae.org or tweet at me at Tommy Tomlinson. What really helps is if you subscribe to Southbound, especially on the NPR One app. That helps our podcast reach an even wider audience. Thanks so much for all your support. Now, back to our conversation with Patterson Hood. So this new record, it's called The Unraveling. And, you know, I have some ideas of my own, but maybe you should say what that title means to you.
This was a hard one to make. It was a hard or to write. It was actually kind of joyous to make. The studio itself part of making this record was the far and away the easy part. And but writing it was really, really hard. For starters, when I wrote the last song that I wrote for American Band, which was Ever South, we had already recorded most of the record before I wrote that. And I think the same applies for Cooley, because his last song was Filthy and Fried. And I did something I've never done since I was 8 years old. I took a year off from writing, and I didn't really intend to, but we were really busy. The press stuff for American Band was like next level from anything we'd ever done as far as the amount of time we put into doing what I'm doing right now, sitting and talking to people about the record. And between that and the exhausting touring that we did behind it, you know, and we're, you know, we are getting older, and we all have families. And so, you know, I'd come home from that, and I've got, you know, still two, you know, young kids and all that goes with that. So so there was about a year that I didn't write anything. And then when I started trying to start writing again, I felt like I didn't know how to do it. It was really weird. It was very foreign. Writing's always been the easiest thing for me. I've never really been given to having writer's blocks or anything like that. You know, I burned myself out a few times, but never really had a, you know, the stereotypical writer's block. And I spent 8 months writing one song. It was really, really kind of frustrating. And, you know, and of course in the back of my head, it's like, what if I can't do this anymore? What if I can't do this anymore? What if I can't, you know, that nagging, you know, you got to beware of the voice in your head, because it's not always your friend, you know? And then the first song I wrote was Perilous Night, which we ended up putting out as a single, just freestanding on its own, right around the time that I finished writing it. And the impetus for finishing that song, which I'd been kind of toying with for months, was what happened in Charlottesville when that young woman was murdered, and then the, you know, commander in chief, you know, gets on TV and basically says that, you know, there was fault on both sides. And I just, you know, just exploded in anger and finished writing that song. And we pretty quickly recorded it and put it out. So then it was like, well, okay, I'm done writing about this shit. I want to write. I want to, you know, it's like, I'm tired of being the, you know, the voice of whatever this is right now. We've said our piece. It's time to move on and do some other stuff. And I basically wrote about an album's worth of stuff that I consider probably a solo record that I hope to make at some point. But at the time, I just was writing it. And it was, felt good to be writing again, and I felt good about the songs. But they didn't feel like trucker songs. It didn't feel like something that I could see us recording and going out and touring as a band behind, because it was way more kind of more something I could see me playing by myself with an acoustic, or maybe with a, you know, a kind of some kind of different stripped down lineup, and definitely not the kind of rooms that we play. And so like, well, now I've got songs, but I still don't have, you know, and by this point, our record's like coming up on, you know, 2 years old, and thinking, well, it'd be nice to maybe do another trucker record, you know, and let's don't forget the day job, you know. And it was kind of a process, but it was like, you know, I kind of was feeling like, you know, I feel like I'm running from something I don't need to run from. I feel like maybe I need to face up to maybe what I need to write about is something I don't want to write about right now, and which is kind of new for me, because generally I write what I want to write. It's like maybe I need to address why I feel this way. And by the time I had that kind of, that I'd kind of come to terms with that, I'm talking to Cooley one morning on the bus, and he said the exact same thing, like word for word. It's like, I think I'm not ready to back down yet, you know. this shit's still happening, you know. And so that's kind of the mindset that then went into writing this record. And I had a breakthrough song, and I wrote a song called 21st Century USA that I wrote on tour, a year and a half ago. And once I wrote that song, all of a sudden it's like, oh, okay, I found my voice. Now I get it. And then it like all happened really naturally, and I had plenty of songs to work with.
Well, this feels like, if you just go through the song titles, you know, Armageddon's Back in Town, Thoughts and Prayers, 21st Century USA, Heroin Again, Babies. It feels like the CNN ticker or something.
I know. I wasn't happy about that necessarily, but at the same time, it's what came out. And it was very natural, you know, and very kind of organic as far as that goes. And, you know, it's a dark time. And I didn't want to run from that. If I know how to do this, then maybe that's my job right now, is to do this at least one more time. You know, I'm pretty dead set that the next record's going to be pretty different from all that. But, you know, I got kids, and I watch them, and I don't know if it may be unfortunately, but they're very aware. I think most kids nowadays are, you know. I don't know if it's because of the internet or just the way the culture is or whatever, but they're more aware than the kids I grew up with. You know, I was kind of a weird kid because I was kind of aware as a kid. I watched the Watergate hearings. I would come home from school when I was 8 or 9 and watch the Watergate hearings. So I was kind of a weirdo. But nowadays, I don't think that would even be weird anymore, at least not where we live, you know. And so I talk to my kids a lot about all that, you know, and they're really upset about things that they see, you know. And not to mention they have lockdown drills at their schools, you know. My kid comes home from, you know, first or second grade at the time, talking about, you know, how they learned how to hide under a desk and all this stuff, you know, and to use their backpacks as a shield if someone's shooting at them. And we did not have that growing up, you know.
I grew up on the coast of Georgia. We had that for like tornado drills.
Right, right.
But not for like a shooter.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, and we all grew up scared that the Russians were going to bomb us or something. Of course, now we're, you know, kissing their butts and trying to get them to help us win elections. But but we grew up scared of nuclear annihilation, I guess. But even that seemed somehow further away than turning on the news and seeing schools getting shot up. I mean, that's just, you know, that wasn't happening. So it kind of wrote itself, and it's not a happy record. It's a pretty dark record. You know, I tell people that it's probably every bit as political as the last record, but it's much more personal. It's really a very, you know, whereas the last record's about these things that were happening, this record is about living with these things that are happening.
The one thing that jumped out at me more than anything was that sort of refrain in Thoughts and Prayers, where you basically say, stick it with those useless thoughts and prayers. Was that something that kind of image came to you right away, or was that just something you felt like you wanted to write about?
It happened exactly like if you're listening to the song the first time, when that line happens is exactly when that line occurred to me. It was like I was almost finished with a song, and that was the capper. You know, I'm real lucky. I mean, I've been writing a long time, I guess, but they generally come to me kind of in order, and it's the better ones come as if I'm listening to a record somewhere and I'm just writing it down as fast as I can. It unfortunately kind of wrote itself because it keeps happening.
I'm sure you have younger musicians and people like that who are maybe looking up to you and looking to advice from you, in the same way that maybe you looked at your dad and his buddies and all that sort of thing. Do you sense that sort of generational thing happening? What would you tell, or what do you tell these younger folks? I mean, you said before, your dad said, don't do this.
Right.
And you did it anyway.
I did it anyway,
So the young people who want to do it and come to talk to you, what do you tell them?
Man, we were talking about Jimmy Johnson earlier, and I got sidetracked and didn't do him justice, but he probably gave me the greatest bit of advice that anyone ever gave me. And obviously I listened to him on that one too. He told me one time, musicians screw up where they, you know, or people in life, you know, your things happen, you know, you go through a divorce or a breakup, some girl breaks your heart, or you're whatever happens. And it's like you see people who that completely derails them. And it's like, but that's wrong. It's like what you do is when whatever bad thing is happening in your life, which inevitably is going to happen, that's the last time you need it to derail you. That's when you find the thing that you do good and you put all of that angst and energy from the bad thing you're going through into the thing you can do, and you let that redeem you. You let that be your redemption. And I mean, that has been a life lesson, and that's definitely something, you know, I want to impart to my kids and to, you know, anyone who will listen. That's really important.
And do you feel like that's been true in your life when you've had bad times or something, you've put it back into the
sure.
music?
Sure. Oh, absolutely. Probably to a fault, you know. I mean, there have certainly been times when, you know, the relationship was hanging by a string, and instead of putting maybe taking off time from this to devote more time to it, I let it go and just put it into that. I mean, I'm sure I've been guilty of that in my life. And, you know, and that's the thing when you have kids, you know, I refuse to do that. I refuse to, you know, I'm keeping it, you know, I got to keep it between the ditches there too, you know, but when I was younger and didn't, I certainly was guilty of that aspect of it. But, you know, we also got some of our best records through some of those times. You know, the Decoration Day album, which when we were writing it was referred to as the Heathens record, the Heathen songs. And, I mean, I was, you know, we were all going through a lot of personal turmoil at the time we were writing that record, because the whole Southern Rock Opera thing, I mean, it nearly killed us. You know, it was a huge ordeal. And the majority of the band went through divorces while making that record, with the one exception being Cooley and his wife, who are still together all these decades later. But they weren't exactly going through a happy time. You know, they just managed to keep it between the ditches somehow. And what we were going through ended up being part of that next record, which is a pretty good record, I think.
But it seemed like he was also, Jimmy Johnson was talking about that doing that process can be like redemptive,
yeah,
in some way. And like, not only do you get good art out of it, but maybe you fix or heal whatever was broken, yeah, or something. I don't know if that's.
I don't think any of us have ever been guilty of, like, and you've heard the cliche of people sabotaging their personal lives in order to get art out of it. And I've always thought that was just ridiculous, because bad shit's going to happen. It's just going to happen, you know? And so it's kind of lame to try to make it, because it's kind of, if you just wait a little bit, there's something bad's going to happen, you know? but it is a way of keeping yourself together so that you can hopefully get around to fixing that stuff or putting your life back together after everything blows apart, you know. And if you, you know, but it's, you've got to have that one thing that you can hang on to.
Ten years ago, when I was living in Boston for a brief time, I went to a concert with some friends. It was a double bill. The Hold Steady, which is a great band out of Minneapolis, and the Drive-By Truckers. They were co-headlining, which meant they'd switch spots every night, and on this night, the Truckers went first. They were amazing. It was a cold night in Boston, but when they left the stage, it felt like the whole place was on fire. At intermission, my friend Chris put on his coat and started heading up the aisle. "Where are you going?" I said. "There's a whole nother band." Chris turned to me and said, "I don't know how good that other band is, but they can't be better than that." Sometimes when you talk to somebody like Patterson Hood about his background, his process, his motivations, you can forget what it all comes down to: creating art that makes other people feel alive. Drive-By Truckers have been doing that for nearly a quarter century now. It's a noble way to make a living. And on these cold nights in America, a song of honesty and hope, a song that makes you feel alive, can be exactly what you need. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our audience engagement producer is Joni Deutsch. Our main theme music comes from Josh Turner. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on the NPR One app, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also find Southbound on WFAE.org, where each episode has show notes with more information on that week's guest. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com. Additional support is provided by the Knight Foundation.